Until recently, New York City has borne the brunt of COVID-19, and today's featured health system was at the epicenter. Through the tireless efforts of staff in the front lines and through leaders who support them, this organization met the crisis head-on by forging new approaches to care. Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Villanueva. And on this episode, we have the privilege to have Dr. Robert Cifolio from NYU Langone Health. Robert, tell us a little bit about your background and your role in this organization.
I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon by training that chose just to do thoracic. And now I'm a pretty much a robotic thoracic surgeon. So I'm a sub-specialist, which everyone hates, including the government. And I got my MBA actually in 2013. At the same time, my poor wife was battling cancer in a battle she lost. So it's a special time for me because I had done 16,000 operations and I knew I wanted to do something more important with my life. And then, you know, God took away the love of my life. So it really focused on what was I going to do in the remaining 20 or 30 years of my work life. So I got my MBA and then really didn't apply it in a regional or healthcare system way until I came to NYU. I was originally at the University of Alabama. I trained at Mayo Clinic, was at Alabama for 20 years, and then came to NYU Langone Health System, which is just a world-class facility with a world-class culture because of a leader named Robert Grossman, who's just an amazing leader that runs a $12 billion organization. I'm honored to report to him directly. And now I get to use my MBA for efficiencies in the OR, accountability, transparency, value, cost reduction, and really delivering the highest quality care in the world. You know, in Vizient, we're always one or two, and we're proud of that because you're the only objective umpire out there. U.S. News and World Report reports how well you look in your uniform. You guys report how well you play on the field.
Thank you for sharing, and thank you for joining us. You know, one of the frequent comments we hear from clinical leadership that dealt with COVID was the importance of being flexible and, quite frankly, being comfortable with dealing with the unknown. What's your perspective on that?
So I love that. As a thoracic surgeon, we deal with the unknown every day. And the key to that is nimbleness. Nimbleness is something major academic institutions don't have. They're giant battleships. And when moved, they move a lot of water, but my God, they move slowly. I would prefer to have the nimbleness of a motorboat, but move the same amount of water as a battleship. And so that is something that we have here. And during COVID, we really put that on steroids. And so instead of having one or two executive leadership meetings a week, we had two a day, 7:30 in the morning and 5:30 at night every day, Saturday, Sunday, every day for 2 months. And on that call was our head of philanthropy, our head of communications, our head of legal, of course, me as COO. We have five hospitals, all our COOs and leaders of our other hospitals are on there. Our CEO and dean, I'm a vice dean of a medical school, all of our leaders together, where we could, as an integrated healthcare system, which is very different from the other systems in New York that own multiple hospitals but are not integrated, where our metric of quality in Brooklyn is the same it is in Long Island or Manhattan or orthopedic hospital. They're all the same. And everyone judged the same. Although there's unique cultures and unique infrastructures and perhaps differences in implementation, quality is the same, processes the same. And it's that integration that made us nimble and able to make amazing changes in hours instead of weeks.
So what I'm hearing is actually there was an acceleration in communication, alignment, and integration.
Yes, I think that's correct. Let me give you an example. Our fourth year medical students became doctors 4 months early. How's that? Our certificate of building in the ER, which we were sitting on for a year, we got done in 3 days and we immediately got cranes on the job site and finished the ER expansion a month ago. That would have taken 3 years, maybe 2.5 to 3 years in the past. We got the certification and it built in 3 months. And so when you do this quickly, it's really hard to go back to the old way, isn't it? It's really unacceptable and impossible. So what we want to do now is leverage this and continue to work in this warp speed like we're doing with the vaccine, Operation Warp, and do that for all of our processes.
Any particular examples using your APPs?
Yeah, so the APPs were interesting. Like, for instance, I'm a robotic lung surgeon. One of them had worked in an ICU. She immediately left the OR because we shut down elective lung surgery, and she was working up in an ICU at a bedside. We leveraged their abilities every way we could in the ICU. You know, we had over 1,200 patients in our healthcare system, over 500 on ventilators, probably even more than you're seeing in Miami right now. And we had 1/5 of the ICU needs. We increased their ICU bed by 5. We did it. Every patient got a ventilator that needed it. every patient got dialysis that needed it. And what I'm most proud of is every staff member got the PPE they needed. We had a very low conversion rate of COVID in our staff, very low.
That's fantastic. What are some of the areas of innovation when it comes to clinical care?
Well, I'll give you an example. So we had rules that you couldn't write on our brand new sliding glass doors. Well, we took care of that in a few seconds. So we started writing everything on the doors so people wouldn't have to go inside and put on their PPE. That allowed us to take our supply chain, cut in 1/4 the amount we were using because we weren't going in the room. We put all the IV poles outside the room and bought 1,000 IV extenders. The nurses could hang meds, change IV drips from outside the room, again, not having to don their PPE. Number two, we used anesthesia machines in our ICU, and no one knows what the settings were for those. So after, and this is my fault as COO, I had this great idea. We put the anesthesia machines up there, and I rounded every day for 101 days with the head of our ICU on every one of our COVID patients in our Manhattan hospital. But the first day we had the anesthesia machines, the nurse said, well, I want to go up on the oxygen. You go in the room. We didn't know how to do it. So within a few hours, we created a one-page laminated sheet that we stuck on that door into the patient's room that told you what the FiO2 was, what the tidal volume was, what the PEEP was, because we didn't know how to read these machines. That was an innovative thing. We delivered food to our doctors and nurses via apps. We leveraged the NYU college campus 15 blocks away because it was empty for their rooms. So doctors and nurses didn't have to go and travel home because mass transit was shut down. So in New York, going to and from work is an issue. We leveraged that. We thought of any way to innovate, to show the staff, and this is probably the most important thing I'll mention today, to show the staff that we supported them. We love them. We're here to provide for their needs, food, sleep, their families. We let their families come in. We tried to provide them scrubs, anything they needed to feel valued and supported, because we know if you take care of your employees, you take care of the health of your organization.
That makes a world of a difference, and particularly when dealing with provider resilience, which we saw to be a huge issue.
I totally agree.
How about in reference to states where, for instance, where I practice in the state of Florida and Arizona and Texas, what would be key takeaways with dealing with the brunt of COVID that you would recommend?
So I think there's a few clinical takeaways. And, you know, we presented a paper in the British Journal that shows amazing outcomes, but we have a follow-up that shows in the last 6 weeks of it, we had less than a 3% mortality with admitted patients. And what was it from? Well, it's not just steroids and remdesivir. I think everyone knows those two things. But using IV heparin when the D-dimers are above 9,000. It was using antifungals when a T2 urinary test suggested the presence of fungus. It was not using central lines, staying away from iatrogenic catheter-related infections. It was early dialysis, even peritoneal dialysis if you're supply chain was short of IV. And finally, the thing that we didn't do well, and again, you always learn from your mistakes, and my God, do we make a lot of mistakes. But one of them was we were intubating patients very early. And I think, and I'll say this out loud because I'm an honest guy, I think hospital personnel felt perhaps they were less likely to get infected when people are intubated. And we learned to tolerate hypoxia, to tolerate hypercapnia. If the patient's awake and alert and talking to you, I don't care how bad their blood gas looked. If they weren't using accessory muscles of respiration to breathe, leave them alone. Just put them on a face mask, treat them with some steroids, some heparin, perhaps remdesivir, and support them and take care of all, dot every I and cross every T, and they would do fine.
You know, for many of my colleagues working out of New York, the one that we found more surprising was the events of acute renal failure. And you've mentioned about going directly to dialysis and even peritoneal dialysis.
I think this was a platelet abnormality, microangiopathic disease. And on autopsy, it was more than that. It was a laminated clot in small vessels, venous and arterial, and it was not just a pure microangiopathic disease. And of course, you see this not just in the solid organ of the kidney, but in the brain and the foot and the arms and the legs. So there was a real hypercoagulable state with this patient that we recognized early, standing on the shoulders of our colleagues in the Far East. And so we were very aggressive with heparin. Now, the mistake we ran is our activated 10A, we probably ran too high at 2 or 3. I think once we lowered that to 1.5, 2, we had less bleeding problems. So again, I think we learned very quickly how to do this better and fine tune it better. But I think IV heparin early makes a big difference here.
Did you ever try low molecular weight heparin versus the IV heparin?
Absolutely. So we had a lot of people who did that. And of course, a lot of patients came in with other problems, you know, with stents, either in the coronary arteries. We found the IV heparin to be more effective than the low molecular weight. And then great controversy. You don't think about it, but a lot of these people went home. What do you put them on when they go home? You put them on Eliquis. We felt strongly that they needed an antiplatelet as well. The jury's out. These are just our opinions with no data. Beware of a surgeon with opinions. Surgeons have lots of opinions. And this is where our experiential evidence took us.
Robert, thank you for telling us your powerful story. We're going to hold over to the next episode and continue our discussion on how your staff faced coronavirus. And to our listeners, please join us for other Modern Practice podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. Also, please listen and subscribe to SG2 Perspectives, the podcast on the latest in healthcare strategies. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks for listening.